Well, it's good to be with you. If you would, we're going to be back in the book of Nehemiah. You can go ahead and turn there to chapter 2. Last week, Brad went super snail's pace at three verses. We're going to go at mock speed today and cover five, so put on your seatbelt. If you are just joining us, for the past couple weeks, we've been studying the book of Nehemiah in the Old Testament. If you're unfamiliar with Nehemiah was an Israelite who was in captivity, in exile. Israelites, they were captured by the Babylonians, who were then captured by the Persians. And here Nehemiah, much like Moses or much like Esther, in a very unique way, God exalts this man in the midst of this slavery to work for the king of the pagan nation that conquered him. And so we find Nehemiah to be the cupbearer for the king, which was a pretty exalted position, much like the right-hand man of any leader. And we've seen through chapter 1 that in a time when Nehemiah is sitting in a very, very decked-out, loaded castle, so to speak, palace in a city of Susa, word comes to him that his people back in Jerusalem lie in desolation, the city's in ruins. And to a guy like Nehemiah, who was very far away from that, his heart was very near, and his heart was broken. He was crushed. And we've been talking about this idea of a holy discontent, when something rubs you so wrong that you've said enough's enough, that you're hit to that place of brokenness, that you need to see something change. You cannot sit any longer in the position that you're in, watching something horrible take place. And that's where Nehemiah was. And so what we see with Nehemiah is that for the next 4 months after hearing this news that his city was in ruins, he goes to the Lord in prayer. For 4 months, he's on his face begging and pleading and confessing to his God, broken over the sin of the people and over his own sin. And, you know, it's interesting. It's very convicting as you read that in chapter 1, isn't it? When you just see this man who's just dedicated to prayer. And it made me kind of reflect a little bit on my marriage. You know, the times that we've had some difficulties in our marriage, there's been a few times where we've had some financial crisis where we didn't know if we're going to be able to pay our bills at the end of the month. You know, you ever been there? And when those times hit, it was very interesting to see the contrast between my wife and me. My wife, the moment she heard news that, oh my goodness, we may bounce a check here, we may not be able to pay some rent, and she goes to her knees. She's in prayer. Meanwhile, I'm in the back room on eBay going, what can I sell, you know? And I'm just typing that in. Did I sell my car, my house, my kids? What do we need to do to pay for this thing? And meanwhile, my wife's over here praying. And it's a reminder, gosh, yes, we need to go to the Lord in those times of crisis. And that's where Nehemiah has been for the past 4 months until we saw last week when he finally decides to go approach the king. Couldn't take it any longer. He needed to go ask for something to be done about the situation that's taking place. And we saw last week as he comes and he, in sadness, goes before the king. And what he's going to do this week is he's going to ask permission to do something about the situation himself. That essentially, if the king would let him take a leave of absence from work so he could go back home and help rebuild his city, which is in ruins. And it's a very interesting situation because we're now moving from the prayer life of Nehemiah to now looking at the plan of Nehemiah. And for many of us, you know, whereas we, you know, see the importance of prayer as we have the past couple weeks, I think for a lot of us, we might struggle in the area of planning. In all reality, we may struggle when it comes to actually fleshing some ideas out so that change can take place. You know, for example, I'm sure there's many of us in here in this room who have these grandiose ideas for our life, right? Many in you, God love you. You have these great plans for your life. You know, you want to make a lot of money. You want to lose weight in 6 days, or you want to, you know, you want to go get that great job. You want to marry this incredible person. Maybe it's noble and very spiritual in nature. You want to see the whole Western seaboard redeemed for Jesus Christ. And so you want to see the gospel go out and all these plans. But in reality, for most of us, we'll never see those things come to fruition because we never took the time to think it through. And for a lot of us, there are huge almost brilliant ideas floating around in our minds, but they'll never, ever get accomplished when we assume that we have to just simply lean on a shovel and pray for a hole, that there has to be some digging that we have to do. And so, you know, when you don't have that plan, you're no different than the hippie jumping on the love bus heading up to Haight-Ashbury thinking, man, we're going to redeem the summer, right? Until you get about 2 weeks in, you're like, man, you ask your friend, did you bring food? Did you bring money for food? No, I thought you were going to bring it. Oh, that stinks. Man, you smell. And I smell too. Where are we going to take a bath? I don't know. I didn't think about it. Next thing you know, like, this is a bad idea. So everybody just kind of scrambles and goes back because life can't be sustained. There needed to be some thought going through it. But some will jump up and they'll say, no, no, no. You can't overemphasize planning. What about scriptures like James chapter 4 that says, come now, you who say today or tomorrow, we'll go into such and such a town and we'll spend a year there and trade and make a profit, yet you don't know what tomorrow is going to bring, do you? What is your life? For you're a mist that appears for a little time and then vanishes. Or what about Proverbs 27:1, which says that there should be no boasting in tomorrow, that you do not know what a day may bring. And so some would say, no, over-planning or planning more would be something that would be unspiritual. You just need to trust God. But those texts that I just quoted, those aren't speaking out against planning. They're speaking out to putting your confidence into your own wisdom rather than the trust in God. And they're speaking out against the person who assumes that tomorrow is a given. But it's not speaking out against being a good steward and planning and thinking through things. We have too many other texts that show us that there is wisdom in planning. Proverbs 6 tells us you and I need to be like ants. We need to learn from ants because all day long they're gathering, right? And they're picking up. It's amazing what those little things can carry. But they're picking up and they're gathering in preparation for a day that might come when there is none. And we need to learn from that the ants prepare. Luke 14, Jesus talking about discipleship, says that before you think about following Jesus, you need to consider the cost. You know, what king would go into battle to fight a war without having first thought through it? What man would go build a tower without first considering what he needs to accomplish it? There needs to be preparation. There needs to be thought into what it is we're doing along with prayer. And so we're going to learn from Nehemiah today that faith in God does not exclude shrewdness and planning. What you're going to see in Nehemiah is that, honestly, planning is a crucial byproduct to a solid faith. That when we trust in God enough, we're willing to act out in obedience to his leadings. And so let's look at Nehemiah's plan. Chapter 2, we're going to be looking at verses 4 through 8. Now remember, in verses 1 through 3 of chapter 2, we saw Nehemiah approach the king. And in sadness concerning his people's situation, and he explains what's going on back home. But in verse 4, the king's going to ask him, what do you want then? What is it you're asking of me? What do you want me to do about it? And so I love this part at the end, before he says anything, so I prayed to God of heaven. He just throws out a quick flare prayer, right? We've all been there, right? We've all done that. We've had those moments where, like Peter stepping out on the water and you start to sink, you're like, help, shortest prayer in the Bible, right? We've all done that. But I love the point this makes about prayer, incidentally. I love the fact that it communicates that God is accessible anywhere, anytime, in any circumstance. He's that near to us that he longs for the prayers of his children. But the difference, I think, between Nehemiah's quick prayer right here and the one you prayed before your final exams is that his prayer most likely was in accordance to everything that he had been praying for the past 4 months solid. And in that moment where he, in trembling fear, stands before this king who in one moment could just take his life if he wanted to, he prays and he throws a prayer out to God asking for blessing. And in verse 5, he begins his approach to asking his request. But I want you to notice exactly how he approaches the king. He says in verse 5, and I said to the king, if it pleases the king. First thing out of his mouth, if it pleases the king. I think there's an important lesson there about his wording and the respect that he pays tribute to this man. He may not respect this man, but he genuinely respects the position. enough that he can come with sincere wording and etiquette and say, if it pleases you, if God would line up your understanding with the one that he's given me, if it would please you, here's what I want to ask you. And I think there's a lesson that we all can learn there on how to approach people. You know, if you're a leader of an organization or a business or a team, then you know what I'm talking about. You know how it is to desire somebody to approach you in the right manner, right? This especially gets dangerous in the church, especially as a pastor. Over the past several years, I've seen so many people in the church who love to come beat up the pastor, right? Come up, I mean, there's like venom shooting out of the teeth when they approach you, and they come out with just demanding requests. They don't even say hi. There's not even acknowledgement. Hey, it's been great to serve here. This is who I am. I mean, I've had people come up, I don't even know who they are, just right out of the gate. When are you going to get this ministry going on in this church? Because we've been doing this thing for 30 years, and you aren't doing it, and God's hand must not be on this church. And yeah, just going on this whole thing, right? And everybody just comes out and just starts demanding and getting accusatory. And I'm like, whoa. Makes me want to treat you like my 4-year-old child and say, all right, we're going to go out of the room. You're going to turn around. You're going to come back in. We're going to try this thing again, all right? Hi, my name is Shay Sumlin. It's good to meet you. There's a lesson that we can learn on respecting people, right? That there's an approach that we can have. You're not going to get anything coming and asking for that. I don't care how bad you want it or how much you've prayed for it. If you're going to come insult me or you're going to come in anger, like you and I have been at enmity for the past 20 years where I don't even know who you are, then don't even bother coming with a request because we're not even going to listen. Nehemiah has an understanding to approach this man with respect. And he says, if it would please you, if God would give you that same understanding that he's given me. But notice here in verse 5, before he goes to the request, he goes a step further. And he says that if your servant has found favor in your sight. I said to the king, if it pleases you, and if you found favor in me. This is an interesting thing that Nehemiah does here. He's going to bank his request on his own faithfulness. This decision of yes or no, you can go do this, is going to rise or fall on who you think I am and on how well I've served you. And so question here, how's Nehemiah been doing in the workplace? How's he been doing on the job? Remember, this is no just quote-unquote secular job for Nehemiah. This goes even further than that. He's a slave in a conquered territory. And he goes and he approaches this king. How do you think he served Artaxerxes in this kind of court? What kind of employee has he been? Has he been late? Has he been not showing up when he's supposed to? Has he been slacking on the job? Has he been slandering the king behind his back? That'd be real easy to do, wouldn't it? When you're in captivity. Just this guy, he doesn't even love God. He hates God, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it'd be real easy to do that. Has he been doing that? Is this a guy who has been stealing from the king? You know, dropping some stuff in the cup when he's supposed to be the cupbearer, right? Is this a guy that's been habitually lazy? I mean, who is it? What is his work ethic? Or has it been that he's been a faithful cupbearer? That he's been a great steward? That he sought the respect of the king and that he wanted to make this kingdom, albeit far from God, he wanted to make it better as an employee? I think we're going to see that this whole request that Nehemiah brings to the table, it's obviously protected and sustained by the providence of God, but the tool that God's going to use in order to unlock the door in this king's heart and mind is the work ethic of Nehemiah. Very interesting. Nehemiah, he has a broken heart. He has a holy discontent for what it is that lies in front of him, but the whole key to this thing is going to be on how he's acted and what's behind him. The whole thing's going to revolve around that. Nehemiah is using his character as a barometer by which the king is going to make his decision. And if you found favor in me, then let this happen. Let me just time out for a second. What's your holy discontent? We've been talking about it for a couple weeks. What's the one thing that's just stirring in you right now that you're saying enough's enough? This needs to change. Is it your marriage? If you're in a marriage, would you love a better marital environment with your spouse? Then question, what kind of spouse have you been that is going to give you the credibility to unlock the heart of your other spouse? What kind of credibility is there? Maybe God's stirring in you right now with just in your own work environments. You would love to see whatever corporation or job that you have change. You would love to see a different environment take place there. Then what kind of employee have you been? If God's giving you ideas for how this thing can improve, what kind of employee have you been that's going to unlock the approval in your boss's mind and heart based on who you've been? Maybe for some of you, it's the city. It's the city around you that you sit and you watch drift further and further, tether further and further from the gospel, from God. And it's stirring within you that you would love to see reform in this city. There are certain areas you would love to see corrected. And God has just given you ideas upon ideas about how this city could improve. Then what kind of citizen have you been that would give you the credibility to approach the mayor or the governor or whoever that could unlock that door? And the list goes on. Whatever that area is, what kind of steward have you been that would give you the credibility to be able to ask one of the biggest questions a man could ask in his day to that kind of king? See, I think it's interesting that the betterment of this noble cause was going to rest on the back of Nehemiah's worth etiquette. I mean, how would you do? How would I do? How would we do? So it's a bold statement by Nehemiah to stand before that king and say that. I think other than maybe the statement the Apostle Paul made when he said, "Follow me as I follow Christ." I mean, it takes a man of character and faithfulness to be able to stand up before somebody and say, "You can bank this whole thing on how I've acted towards you or how I've acted towards my God." Man, that's a lot of character to be able to say something like that. Anyways, imagine, though, just the kind of influences you and I could have if we stewarded the areas that God's given us with excellence, not as unto the person that we're serving, but as unto our God, that would bring him glory and honor. Well, here's the request at the end of verse 5. That if it pleases you, King, if I've done anything right in your eyes, then would you send me to Judah, to the city of my father's graves, that I may rebuild it. Send me. Essentially what he's saying is, I would like to leave my job for a period of time so that I could go home and rebuild the city that lies in ruins. Now, we saw in verse 3 last week why the idea of his father's grave was so sentimental, but here's what's absolutely amazing about this question. Because we know from Ezra chapter 4, verses 7 through 23, that previously this question had already been asked. And the king at that time had allowed the people to return and start building, but then dissension got stirring, got back to the king, and the king shut it down. He changed it. And he said, no more rebuilding. If this city rebuilds, they're going to end up rising up against us, so no more. And so for years now that have passed, that has been the decree. And what's amazing is that Nehemiah now comes in and essentially is asking, I need you to reverse your decision. I need you to change, essentially, your foreign policy concerning other nations such as Israel. And I had a prof one time who told me, he said, you know, this is essentially, even though it's a little bit exaggerated here, but it's essentially the same thing. Imagine being in Hitler's army and being his right-hand man and going into his chamber and walking up to him, said, you know what? I respect you as a leader, but honestly, could you lay off Poland and Austria for a while? And instead, what I would love you to do, I want you to change your policy on this whole annexation, extermination thing. I would love you to allow me to go in and actually rule those territories, help build back up the Jewish population so that we can thrive. And in doing so, I need you to go public so that essentially everyone will know, so that way nobody's going to stop us from doing that. Would that be cool? Can you imagine that? I mean, a little exaggerated, not the same scenario necessarily as the king of Persia here, but imagine just walking in, and that's essentially what you're asking for. Can I go do this? Now, you know, what if, and here's where we get into the whole planning thing, essentially, because the king's going to ask him here, well, what's it going to take? What's it going to take? How long is this going to take place? When are you going to come back? And in verse 6, the king said to me, with the queen sitting beside him, how long will you be gone? When will you return? So the king wants to know, do you have a plan? Now, Nehemiah doesn't tell us here exactly how long this was going to take, but you can find out, don't turn there, but in chapter 5, verse 14, we find out later what Nehemiah asked for was 12 years. He wanted to take off work for 12 years. Can you imagine that for a minute? Imagine wherever you work right now, even if you're just a stay-at-home mom, all right, asking, can I take 12 years off and then come back? That's ridiculous. Can you imagine? Nobody's going to let you do that. And paid leave while you're at it, right? Nobody's going to let you do that. But he's asking. The reason he's asking is because he knew what it would take. He had thought through this thing. Nehemiah wasn't just showing up and trying to undershoot this thing so he could sugarcoat it and get what he wanted. He had thought through exactly how long is it going to take to rebuild a wall around a city? How long is it going to take to reinstitute just an entire city itself? And he calculated it's going to be about 12 years, so he lays it out there. And he asked for 12 years off. But here's what's another thing that's amazing about this thing in Nehemiah. I want to go back to the character for a moment. It doesn't say this here, but you remember the king wanted to know, when are you going to come back? What do you think? After 12 years, would you come back? After going and rebuilding your city, would you come back into captivity 12 years later? In Nehemiah chapter 13, verse 6, tells us that Nehemiah came back exactly 12 years later. He did exactly what he said he was going to do. The character of Nehemiah, just the fulfilling what he promised he would do. Jesus referred to it as letting your yes be yes and your no be no. When you say you're going to do something, do it. And Nehemiah does. So the first part of Nehemiah's plan here, though, would be thinking through how long is this project going to take? How long is it going to take me to complete this? In verse 7, Nehemiah also shows us that he's thought through some other things as well. He's thought through what it's going to take to travel all the way to Jerusalem. Look at this in verse 7. And I said to the king, if it pleases the king, let letters be given to me so that I can give them to the governors of all the provinces beyond the river, that they would let me pass through until I can get back to Judah. And so he's thought through, you know, some of the problems concerning traveling through some alien territory. The distance between Susa and Jerusalem is around 350 to 400 miles. It's a long way to travel to go rebuild this thing. And in between that distance, there lied several provinces that Persia owned, so to speak, that they appointed governors over. And these governors, you're going to meet two of them next week in verses 9 and 10. They didn't particularly like the Jewish people. And they didn't like the idea of Nehemiah getting to go back and rebuild this thing. They're the ones who complained that they wanted this thing to stop to begin with. And so Nehemiah thought through enough to know that on his way back, he's going to pass through these territories. And these are men who would love to capture him, if not kill him, for pursuing this project. So Nehemiah, he needs the king to publicly issue an edict reversing that policy, handing letters to him so he can give to these governors that say, the king said I could do it, so he could travel safely. So Nehemiah thought through what it was going to take, how long it was going to take, and what it was going to take to get there. But there's more to his plan. In verse 8, he's going to think through the enormous resources that he's going to need to rebuild the city. He says, and I also need a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber. And so it's interesting, outside of Susa, the king had kind of this private forest reserve area that had the best timber available that the king had, king and only the king had access to in order to fund the projects that the king needed to fund. Nobody was allowed to touch them. In fact, he hired this guy named Asaph, whose job was to make sure that no poachers or no thieves got in there and were stealing resources, cutting down trees, and doing this type of thing. And so Nehemiah essentially is asking for the king to not only give him permission to get in there, but to fund this thing, to give him the king's supply of timber. Now, that's no small ask here. That's crazy, because think about what he needed in terms of lumber. Keep going at the end of in the verse 8 here. I needed the timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress of the temple and for the wall of the city and for the house that I'm going to live in. I mean, think about the enormity of this project. He needed a lot of timber in this thing. Just the wall itself was around 5 miles long. The surface area of the wall was about 960 acres. And in between, at certain spots, he wanted gates. There were going to be these huge beams supporting it. He wanted timber for the house that he was going to live in. He wanted timber for the, for the fortress that's outside of that. And so all these resources he needed, Nehemiah, did he have a large vision for this project? Absolutely. Is he shooting for the moon in this thing? Absolutely. But does Nehemiah have a big God? You better believe he does. So Nehemiah isn't afraid, in a sense, to ask for all this because he knows this is what it's going to take. He had thought through it. Now don't miss the heart in all of this. This isn't a man who's looking for an out from Susa so he can go build into his own kingdom and exalt himself. This is a man who's broken. This is a man who's crushed over the sin of his people, the sin of himself, the desolation of God's house. He's had enough. No more of it. And so he's tired of God's name getting spit on. He's tired of God's fame getting demoted. He wants to see this thing built back up. And, you know, we know from the book of Ezekiel that God was looking for someone who would stand in the gap, who could help rebuild this thing. And so 100 years later, Nehemiah comes along and he says, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'll do it. Send me. I'll go. And so for 4 months, he prays and he plans and he seeks the hand of God and he strategizes about what it's going to take. And so he's not asking for his own accord. He's asking all of this so that the name of God would be exalted, that the other nations would stop making fun of God because his people were constantly in exile. He wanted to see God and God's people restored to their rightful place. And so he comes with this big question. And so drum roll, what's the king's response? He was in favor of it in verse 6, but in verse 8 he's going to give his final decision here. It says, and the king granted me what I asked, for the good hand of my God was upon me. The king said, go for it. The king said, do it. A miracle just took place. Now, why did that happen? Nehemiah says it's because God's hand was upon him. Why was God's hand upon him? Well, I think you can look at it. First of all, we know, and we've talked about it already in this series, 2 Chronicles 16:9, for the eyes of the Lord move to and fro throughout the earth that he may strongly support those whose heart is completely his. Nehemiah is a man of character. He's broken in spirit. He's humble. He's repentant. He is prayerful for the heart of God. He's strategic in his thought process and not lazy in thinking through things, and he was faithful in his previous stewardships under the king. And so, yeah, God's hand was on him. But don't get it mixed up here. The hero of the story is not Nehemiah. We're in no way saying that this request was granted because Nehemiah was slick and he just had the right kind of panache, you know, to go in there to the king and use some slick used car salesman words and hopefully turn this thing over. No, it's not that way at all. In fact, half the time you see Nehemiah shaking in his boots, he's scared, he's in prayer. But he says here, the hero of the story is God. God wanted this to happen. God was looking for somebody who was willing to step in. God puts his hand on Nehemiah. And so, no, ultimately, it's God who accomplishes this whole deal. But understand that the vessel by which God accomplished it was through the prayers and through the planning of Nehemiah. Both there. So question, does a faithful prayer life exclude planning? No, not according to Nehemiah. They go hand in hand together. It's having something stir in your heart and wanting to do something about it. Trusting in God enough to fall on your face in repentance and beg and plead for the only one who can unlock that door, but also using the mind that he's given you and the creativity he's given you to begin fleshing those ideas out so that when the time comes, he can go forward. Can you imagine if Nehemiah had gone in there and the king said, so what's your plan? And Nehemiah just went, I don't know. And just shrugged his shoulders and said, flip a coin, I don't know. He'd be one and done. It'd be over. But Nehemiah had a plan. He could think through it. And so a couple things I want us to take away from this as we look through this passage. First of all, understand right off the bat, God can do anything. God can do anything he wants. Proverbs 21:1, the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever he wants. God can move in anybody. I've heard so many stories recently of people who are going over into the Middle East, into these places where it is almost impossible to go not only share your faith in this country, but to even get in this country. I was talking to two guys back in Texas recently who just their heart was stirring, seeing Islam just spread and just literally saturating the whole, you know, European and Middle East continents over there and trekking its way west and just stirring, going, you know, I don't want this to take place. I want Jesus Christ to be exalted. What can we do about it? We're just two people, and these are two businessmen. And there is a portion in the Middle East country where not even our own U.S. diplomats could get into. But these guys found a way through their corporation to develop a strategic partnership with this country so that they could get into the country and then eventually got to the heart of the king and have opportunities now to actually share not only about their corporation, but also their faith. These are men who had just started with a holy discontent within them, praying and begging God for open the door, but sitting down and drawing up some ways that they could do it. And God unlocked the door. And those stories are happening everywhere. Surely you all know folks all over the place who just started with a little seed in the inner city of something that could happen, or maybe a seed about how hunger and poverty could be, you know, rid of, and then start creating thoughts and started praying through it. Next thing you know, organizations pop up, and you got people now going and putting wells over in foreign countries and starting inner city ministries. And it's the people who not only pray, but get down and actually plan out what could happen if we had the opportunity. So God can do anything. And so along with that, the second thing I'd tell you is don't be afraid to plan. In accompaniment with your prayers, don't be afraid to plan. It's how God chooses to work. And so let me just ask this question again. What is your holy discontent? What is it that's stirring in you right now that literally is getting to the point that you can't sleep at night? Is there something there? Is there something going on within you right now where you said, enough is enough? I'm tired of sitting right here in this place that I'm at and looking down the road and seeing this every single week, and I want something to stop. Again, maybe for some of you it's marriage. Maybe you just come from a long line of leavers. And everybody in your family is checked out at one point or another. Dad's walked away. Mom's walked away. And maybe God is stirring within you right now to say, enough is enough. I'm tired of seeing the divorce rate happen in my family. I'm tired of seeing the divorce rate happen in our culture. I'm tired of seeing broken families and kids growing up confused and directionless. I'm tired of taking my kids to school and watching all these other kids with their parents who don't even pick them up because they don't even care. And God's stirring something within you to say, enough is enough. And what are you going to do about it? Are you on your face in prayer, seeking the hand of God that He could intervene and change this thing and quit all these statistics we're seeing in our country right now? Are you thinking through what can you do to turn this thing around? How can you be the change agent? You know, for some of you, maybe it's the city, right? Maybe there's a passion here. Maybe you're tired of seeing one half of the city that is so completely plush and seeing another city that is so completely broken down. And wondering every day, why is there such a difference? Why do people live in such poverty in the city around me? Why is there so much homeless? Why on every single street corner I pass by, there's somebody with a sign asking for something? And maybe that's stirring in with you. Maybe not everyone, but maybe you. And maybe there's an opportunity that God is just putting within you, a seed, a dream for how that thing can get turned around. And you want to see reform in that city. Are you on your face begging for the hand of God? And have you begun to think through a plan for how this thing can get turned around? Folks, don't be afraid to pray and don't be afraid to plan. Nehemiah asked a big question because he had a big God. Don't be afraid to ask the big question. If there are things stirring within you for this church, things you would love to see implemented, put them down on paper. Write them down. Verbalize them, and then don't be afraid to come ask. And then after you've prayed for it for a while, don't be afraid when God answers it and gives you the opportunity to now do something about it. Whatever your holy discontent is, wherever it's stirring in you right now, let's go to our face in prayer And let's plan, let's think through, let's implement some things that this thing can get turned around, whatever that might be. Imagine what kind of influence we as a Christian community could have, not only here in our city, but everywhere else, if we had Christians who were that committed to praying and planning through this thing. Wouldn't that be incredible, what the Lord could do? Let's pray for that. Our Father, we thank you just for the words of Nehemiah. Very basic text, Lord. Very just almost systematic in just how it all kind of unfolds here. But Lord, yet we don't want to miss the miraculousness behind it. That for an unlikely man in a very unlikely time, in a very scary place, it just took the right stir within him, Lord. A holy discontent and brokenness for the sin of your people and the sin of himself. And Father, just the leading that you put on Nehemiah just to pray through that and develop a plan and present it to the king, and then you answered. And what is about to unfold in these next few pages as we progress through this is nothing short of a miracle of what you are capable of doing. And I do not believe, Lord, for 1 minute that what you did in Nehemiah's day can't happen today. In our marriages, in our families, in our friendships, in our churches, in our city, in our nation, in our world. The things, Lord, that you would love to see happen, Lord, you are searching right now for someone or some group that you can strongly support. Father, might we be that here at the Well Community Church? Might we be your children who yield ourselves to you in prayer and who strategically plan, and that your blessing might follow, Father. We lift that up for the sake of your kingdom. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.